for tonight's show. We have a bunch of new releases, mostly longer tracks other than this last piece that's playing. Thank you for listening, and good night.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. I've been a member of KBOO since 1987. I really appreciate their support of the multicultural community in Portland, Oregon, local music, and the preservation of blues.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, keeping Portland safe and in touch. Community radio has never been more important than right now, and KBOO needs your help. Due to the pandemic conditions, we've had to cancel our spring membership drive. As you may know, KBOO is normally member supported. So instead, we're asking listeners to donate on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/give. That's kboo.fm/give. We are a nonprofit, listener-supported community resource for people like you. We know these are hard times. A lot of people are facing financial hardships, but every little bit helps. So donate whatever you can for the radio station you know and love, KBOO FM. Keep us on the air. This is Wider Window Poetry, and I am your host, Teal Ansari, bringing you voices you may not have heard from places you may not have been. And I have a guest this month, but before I introduce my guest, I would like to read a couple of poets by Yang Mu. Yang Mu is a Taiwanese poet. He was born in Taiwan in 1940, and he studied at both University of Iowa and UC Berkeley in the 60s, and then returned to Taiwan, has lived and written there ever since. He's considered one of the foremost modern poets writing in Chinese, and his poetics allude to both classical Chinese and classical Western modes and models. And I'm gonna read from a collection of his poems titled Hawk of the Mind, which was edited by Michelle Yee. And the first poem I'd like to read is titled Folding Screen. First, the wall's particular mood matures behind warp and woof of satin and paper, like a crop anticipating autumn. An illusion reaches from the painting on the screen, transmitted through a teapot, snagging with a smile, knocking over landscapes and butterflies in swift vehicle and sojourns at inns. Forlorn, guilty, packing a familiar tune. Don't know the mood when the sun sets and dew falls. I paint my eyebrows while you head for the wine shop. And then the second poem I'd like to read is titled The Vacated Seat. And it starts with an epigram from Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Many fells he climbed over in territory strange. Far distant from his friends, like an alien he rides. In the room, there's a whiff of autumn leaves burning. As when in days gone by, while reading by the window, you chanced to hear in the wind chimes hanging from the eaves of a far-off building, a vaguely discernible solitude. I know all too well, when I turn this page, our hero will rise from his chair, clad himself in armor, feed his mount, test his blade, and inspect his pennant, then set forth against all odds to vanquish those fire-breathing dragons and whatnot, thus saving the proverbial damsel in distress from Castle Perilous. His chair sits emptily there in the uncertain sunlight, basking hour after hour. That was Yang Mu. And now I would like to introduce this month's guest, Anis Mojgani, the current Poet Laureate of Oregon, just recently appointed. Anis is a two-time individual champion of the National Poetry Slam, winner of the International World Cup Poetry Slam, and has had residencies at the Vermont Studio Center, Air Serenby, the Blodel Nature Reserve, and the Southwester, as well as Oregon's Literary Arts Writers in the Schools program. He's written 5 books of poetry, has done commissioned work for the Getty Museum, Peabody Essex Museum, has given multiple TED Talks, and in April 21 will be premiering his first opera libretto titled Sanctuaries. Anis's work has appeared on HBO, National Public Radio, has been in the Academy of American Poets Poem A Day series, as well as many journals including Rattle, Platypus, Winter Tangerine, Forklift Ohio, and Bat City Review. Actually, that list of titles is a pretty good line of poetry in itself. He's performed at hundreds of universities across the U.S. and festivals around the globe. Is originally from New Orleans and currently lives right here in Portland, Oregon. And you can find more about Anis at his website, which is thepianofarm.com, the piano farm, that's all one word, or on the Cultural Trust website, culturaltrust.org, under the Poet Laureate, Oregon Poet Laureate section. Welcome, Anis.
Thanks for having me, Teal. Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
So, we would like to hear some of your poetry now.
Will do. I guess I'll just start sharing some and see which ones I end up reading and sharing for you guys. Let me grab some of these and see what's up. This is titled Hun, as in short for honey. Or, we have both traveled from the other side of the hill, one side of which we may wish we could forget. Love me stupid, love me terrible, and when I am no mountain, but rather a monsoon of imperfect thunder, love me. When I am blue in my face from swallowing myself, yet wearing my best heart, even if my best heart is a century of hunger, an angry mule breathing hard, or perhaps even hopeful, a small sun, little and bright. Come closer. Come into this. Come closer. You are quite the beauty. If no one has ever told you that before, know that right now you are quite the beauty. There is joy in how your mouth dances with your teeth. Your smile is a sign of how safe your life actually is, so step into it. Come closer. Know that whatever God prays to, they asked of it to help them make something of worth. They woke from dreams, scraped the soil from spaces, stuck somewhere inside themselves, made you and were happy. You make that, Lord, happy. Come into this. Come closer. Know that something softer than us, but just as holy, planted pieces of itself into our feet that we might one day dance our way back. Know that you are almost home. Come just a little bit closer. There are birds beating their wings beneath your breastplates, gentle sparrows aching to sing. Come aching hearts, come soldiers of joy, doormen of truth. Know that my heart was too big for my body, so I let it go. And most days, this world has thinned me to where I'm just another cloud, forgetting another flock of swans, having shaved off so many of my corners that I have felt at home only in the shape of a ball, bending myself so far backwards that the song of my mother believed I was returning home. But believe me when I tell you how my soul has managed to squeeze itself into very narrow spaces. Place your hand beneath your head when you sleep tonight, and perhaps you will find it there, making beauty as we dream, making beauty as we sleep, making beauty as we turn over. When we turn over in the ground, may the ghosts that we have asked our answers of do that turning, kneading us into crumbs of light and into this thing, love thing called life. Come into it, come, you wooden museums, gentle tigers, little giants. I see teacups in your smiles, upside down, glowing. Your hearts are like my hands. Some days all they do is tremble. I am like you. I am just like you. I too at times am filled with so much fear, but like a hallway must find the strength to walk through it. Walk through this with me, through this church of blood, bone, and muscle that is ours. There's a doorknob glowing like chance. Clutch it, turn and pull, step through, back straight, chin up, eyes open, hearts loud. Walk through this with me. Walk through this with me. That was actually two poems. The first one, Hun, and the second one is a poem called Closer. So this is a poem about, as Teal mentioned originally, I'm from New Orleans, and I've been in Portland now. I first moved here in 2004 and left for a little bit, but then came back. But this is a poem called Four Stars about growing up in New Orleans. There was a wasp nest on the back porch. It looked like dead honeycomb. Outside was a hornet's hive. I stuck my hand out there, and the sun buzzed loudly. Nothing could bite me. A caterpillar did. I climbed its tree. It kissed me with its back. Its hair was sharp enough to leave four stars spinning in my palm. The world spun through my arms and crashed onto our street, so I picked it up. At the back of the backyard was a tin shed falling apart. Inside it, I swear there was a giant sleeping. I woke him, told him my dreams, and led him humming back into our yellow kitchen. The countertops were always covered in topsoil. My mother, she loved to garden and to collect marbles inside of mason jars. We were never allowed to touch them. I loved the smell of the air conditioner. There was a window unit in the dining room and one in my parents' bedroom. Putting my face in front of the vents made me feel like Sunday. I could bike the whole square of the block in 2 minutes flat. My friends Jalal, Putt, and Rue, they lived around the corner from us. There was a tree in front of their house too big to be a birch. My friend Sam lived only two fence hops away. His mother showed mine what God looked like. God, he smelled like my father. Both their beards were black bears. Me and Mom, we went fishing in the park. I caught two catfish and waited for them to die. They swam in circles inside of our refrigerator because no one had ever taught me how to kill anything. In Mississippi, we ate every single perch that I caught. The grasshoppers there, they're the size of an almond joy. My sister, she had a pet rat. Part of his ear was gone. His name was Pierre. I named my pet mouse after a favorite book, Charlotte's Web. She is buried under a white rock in the backyard. The day our dog died, Pops found him hanging from the clothesline. I cried into my pillow. I was 10 years old. I could fit under the house. My knees didn't care. Neither did the dark. After the tub, the hallway away from the bathroom to mine was a dark tunnel breathing only to swallow me. I shivered and was more afraid of that walk than anything ever since. Even now, there are moments where it still shakes me, but there were times when the night sat beside me on my bed quietly, like it was a big man who had to do what I told him to do. He was too dumb, or he loved me too much. Either way, he had the same smile. I had never been stung by a bee before. Not my whole life. Not my whole life. There was a poem I wanted to share that is a very new one. I don't know if it's out yet. I'm trying. It's should be in the July issue of Portland Monthly. They had asked me to write a poem under the theme of New City. And so This is a poem that speaks to some of the things from over the last decade or so here in Portland. And this is called City of Flowers. You remember how it was? Like the floorboards of our houses had soaked the tears or sweat out of the dirt we stood on. A monsoon of our wishes come arriving in a different form. Murky the water was, too rich with the loam for us to drink away, though many of us tried and died doing so. And the blossoms, so thirsty, were now radiant from their gluttony, some days a prayerful sweetness that we convinced ourselves we did not deserve, and on other days some sort of cosmic joke, their perfume filling our sagging, waterlogged hallways. Of course, with the flowers came those bees, buzzing all day and night, barely sleeping we were. So many of them, we'd breathe deeply and swallow a fistful so often till the stinging on the inside felt just a thing like heartburn, and the stings on the outside just another part of the skin. And the city never came to take care of any of it, but then as soon as we left, and of course we left those that could, because how can a person live with a living room made of a muddy river? And how can a people live in a place where they're more chrysanthemum than people and more bees than red petals collecting in the drains, so more stings than not? So of course, all of us that could leave did. And after we did, then the city came out and killed all those bees. Which means also, there ain't no flowers, because no flowers if no bees. But of course, all the new people living here now together, they wonder, where all my flowers go? I pay my taxes. Where indeed? So the city, they come back in, and for all the new people, they put all these fake flowers in the ground, and they even water them, water for flowers that ain't even real. And they're all happy with that, I guess, flowers that ain't real and water that is, and spending tax money, they say, to pay for folks who brown like the earth we pour our water into to travel back to where they once lived in order to water flowers that was made in a machine that don't even need no water anyway, taking care of growing things that don't grow for people that won't grow anything for themselves, none neither anyway, just so they can say, there's nothing wrong about this, nothing strange about this. This is how it's always been, and look how the flowers look, like it's always springtime. Just so I can keep track of time, how much more time should I read for Timo?
Oh, I'm so enjoying listening to you. Like, you could go on forever.
Oh.
But let me ask you about that poem. So it's for Portland Monthly, and mm-hmm. is that a paper journal or an online or both? Do you know?
So it's generally it's actually a magazine out of Portland, and so it, you know, will. It's less literary and more articles just about Portland and different stories and cultural aspects that are going on in the city month to month. But they tend to do, I don't know if they do it regularly, having poetry and prose in it month to month, but I know in the summertime, I think like in the summer issue, they tend to commission poems and pieces of prose from Portland writers. And so that, as far as I know, like, I don't know if their print has changed in regards to COVID, but it's a monthly magazine that comes out. So I imagine that it'll be, you know, if it's not on the stands now, it should be at some point. But it generally is also the work will be shared online as well.
I see.
So it should be both of those in this coming month.
So if you could read a couple more poems, and then I have some questions I would like to ask you.
Will do. Leading off of springtime, I'll read this. And this is a poem that actually closes out my most recent book, which is now 2 years old, and it's called In the Pockets of Small Gods. And this is called Perseus's Spoon. And when spring arrived, I took a class to learn something I had never before learned, and a thing I thought I might love. how did we make it through this winter after the year we had, and while knowing what awaited us in the new one? How amazing we who have stayed are, how beautiful and heavy and vulnerable we who couldn't were. When spring arrived, I learned how to carve from wood a large spoon. I hadn't ever done that before, and I haven't done it again since yet, but I learned it as I've learned more how to hold my heart again and whisper into it and once more listen a little better to the songs it sings, even mouthless, with no mouth it sings, and even when no note heard nor even made, I am listening, or at least learning, to always try to. So perhaps it is not the longest night we at times find ourselves in, but simply the slowest dew forming upon us. And I'll read this other one from the same book. That's a little bit longer. When you're in your coffin, clanging down the river with all the other coffins in the water of the next world, all of them bumping and jostling against one another, the contents thrown about like riding in a small plane, you'll peek your head up to see what the racket is. You'll see the other coffins. Looking around, you'll see nothing but coffins and river and two banks distantly flanking the river and the biggest, tallest, dark stretching above. So dark it feels like this place, big as it is, must be inside some sort of bigger place. There are still stars, though. Wherever this river is, you can still see the stars. And while looking around, you'll see that there are other heads peeking out of their coffins. And you yell across the dark, asking, "Do you know where we are?" And someone will answer back, "No, you, no," you say back. You ask somebody else, "What about you?" "No, I wonder where this is." And someone else will say, "I don't know, but it's big." "Yeah, big." And someone else, "Yeah, so big, it's vast." And depending on what part of the river you're in, someone else on the river may then say, "Yeah, vast like the backside of Sean Brown." And though no one on the river knows who Sean Brown is, people on the river will laugh. The chuckles will subside until a quiet sets in over the laughter, a quiet like you sat down in somebody else's church. And someone will then ask someone else, "Where are you from?" And they will say, "Texas." "What about you?" "Boston." "Boston? Yeah, Boston. I know someone from Boston. Kate Lee." "You know her?" "No." "What about Stephen Ellis?" "Well, I'm actually in Somerville," they'll say. "Somerville? Yeah, Somerville." And someone else will then yell out, "Somerville? I know someone in Somerville." "Who?" "Nick Cathcart. You know him?" "I do. I do know him. Yeah? Yeah. Oh, man, small world. Yeah, Nicky's a great guy. He is. I hadn't seen him in 5-10 years, and when I did, he had a first edition of an E.E. Cummings book to give me. Great guy." And the first person may or may not know who E.E. Cummings is, but will still agree that, yes, Nicky is a great guy. And then it will get quiet again until someone else asks, "Where is it that we are?" And no one will answer. A few people shrug. All of you will look into the stars that are collecting in the distance overhead. You'll try to think of someone you might know that lives in Somerville or Texas or Florida or France, just to have something to talk about with a person you never met before, just right now, just to share something in this dark quiet, even though all of you are already sharing the river and the sound of the current bumping all of you into one another, and you'll wonder where the water is taking you and how long it will be before it brings you there and what there will be like, if it'll be like here on the river with all of us sitting in our boxes trying to split the dark by sharing our voice with others, if it'll be like how it was in the world before this one.
That's a very poignant poem, especially in this time of a lot of isolation, you know, that the reaching out, trying to make contact, trying to find some common experience. So
especially
I wanted,
especially with like so many of us now connecting like through screens, you know.
Yeah. So I wanted to congratulate you first on your appointment as poet laureate.
Oh, thank you.
And Can you tell us a little bit, what are the expectations with that position? What is your job?
My job, I guess, is I have been phrasing it as it is my duty, my responsibility, my whatever, to be a steward to and for poetry, to and for the people of Oregon. And so for me, what that means is finding the ways that to hopefully create a wider population of people who have a relationship to poetry, to find new ways to ask and bring people to the engagement of poetry. As it being specific to the state, you know, finding those ways in which, what does it mean, at least for me, what does it mean to, like, for all the people that live in this one state, what does that mean? And how can poetry feasibly be an element, a tool that allows for us to be bonded as Oregonians? What are the common ways that, like, we hopefully love and react to this state that we all live in? And what are those ways that might be ways that bridge us closer, as opposed to, like, create more distance because of our differences? So those are the things that I think about doing and figuring out how to do with this appointment.
Well, these are certainly difficult circumstances. this wasn't the time anyone would have picked to go about a project like this, I think. But
definitely.
What are some strategies that you're trying to bring to bear, you know, given the great geographic and cultural diversity of a state like this and the current circumstances?
It's definitely, strange. I think generally so much of the role, whatever it is that a poet laureate might be doing with regards to, like, the projects that they may be engaging in, a lot of it really comes down to how the laureate is connecting with those individuals and those communities around the state. And so, you know, currently that's not something that I'm able to do in person. I was speaking with one of the folks at the who is in an aiding capacity with the program to me. We were speaking the other day about how are some of the ways that we can be doing this, particularly with, you know, ideally, I remember, at the start of the appointing, hoping that, but also still unsure as to, like, what would it mean 3 months from now, 4 months from then, 6 months from then, a year from then? What is the shape of, like, and the reality of me getting to go to these different communities? And, definitely, ideally, it would have been fantastic to feel like, yes, I can definitely go places sometime in the summer or sometime in the fall. And the fall may be a reality, I don't know, but it also is not necessarily the ideal circumstance. And so it's definitely, like, you know, trying to figure out, well, what are the things that I can do that allow me to, if I'm not in person with these communities, what are the projects that I can engage in? And so there's which honestly is still really exciting. I'm a person that the easier a thing is, the less energy I have to do it. I guess I could go do this thing that is, like, very easy to figure out. But, like, the thing that I love about the creativity machine is that the more hurdles, the more boundaries, the more challenges in place, the more that it gets, like, me problem solving and figuring out, well, what can I do in this scenario? What can I do in this situation? And so there's definitely like projects from afar that I'm excited about to kind of like explore, but also excited to kind of see where and how, like I want, you know, like I love that, I'm thankful that we live in an era that we're able to do something like this, that I'm able to like say, do virtual appearances, do virtual workshops, do virtual readings. And I'm definitely thankful that like it's not completely removed, that those are all things in, that can be manifested. But I'm also curious, and this was like a large part of our conversation the other day, of how can I feasibly visit communities in person while maintaining things safe and healthy and respectful in this age of COVID. And so I am exploring like, all right, what does it mean to create a live show, a live performance that is also seeking to not be indoors, that is also seeking to maintain space amongst people, you know? And so I'm currently exploring like what that looks like and how to hopefully manifest that. So we'll see in the coming months what form that takes.
So still taking shape.
Yeah.
How about if you could read a couple more poems? Then I have some different questions.
All right, we'll do. There was a poem I was going to read. What was it? Oh, that's right. And this is a poem called, what is the name of it? The Body, the Echo of the Blood. And actually, I'll read these two poems that are back to back in this book. The second one is I Took Apollo's Cows by Moving Backwards. Hand clap in my blood, my sister's heart, pregnant with love like our mother, always growing flowers in the rain. How hard she has learned to move easily through the world. When I dream my brother, I dream him always 7 years old. There's a Cossack in my chest that sometimes drinks down his own sorrow, sometimes by himself, sometimes loudly. The Cossack drowns himself until the angel in him sings. There are stories, and then there is what is below. All that is light in me falls and thunders its way out. Everything dark lightly approaches. Held in my hands is a black bowl of warm black. I drink it happily alone. Sometimes when others walk past, I still wonder if I may. Sometimes when others walk past, I slurp louder that they might know of what it is I swallow. May my father be given the softest bed. May his most perfect music always sing his most perfect smile, the warmth of his gentle mouth. May my mother always mother. May my mother always be. There are coffins in me built only from orange trees. May my graveyards learn from both. All the dogs in me talk through the moon to the dogs in you. I have met young ones I wished were my daughters. May their always hearts always be dark umbrellas turned inside out, catching the sun. May we all stop breaking ourselves to hear our songs. May we all stop breaking others simply to have a sound to dance to. If my boat is body, the bow smiles back at where it once was. The stern seeks to see the approaching horizon, the hull of my heart filled with dresses of silk for those who I have loved. When my body was a boat, what the boat of my body wished was to carry itself home to a wife, but she was gone. If my body is a boat, all it wishes is to hold all of me over every sea and through every night, carrying bolts and bolts of shining and yellow fabric, magically spun from out some distant land and journeyed back to the place that has known my sound. If you see me walk past with one shoulder higher than the other, under a sky so black it is blue, above an ocean so blue it is black, my starboard hand is trailing behind into one of the two, filling my left with stars. Since we're talking about Oregon Poet Laureate stuff, here's a poem I wrote some years ago, summertime in Oregon, called Along the Sandy. There were two trips we made together to the river. The first one with everyone else, you in your new secondhand swimsuit that fit loosely, Aaron threw mud on your back. On the following trip, I swallowed water offshore. I thought I would drown, and you tried to help me. No matter the weight of the day or the lightness of the night, my body holds these trips, along with the crest of the Northwest, the mountains of its giants and its trees. The life it gave me is carried by my body. I'm thankful for how the dark hands of Oregon held us, that the bees in my chest finally slept soundly, that fruit grew, that fruit was picked by us from both our bodies, held up in the sunlight, turned over in our hands with wonder, and then shared with each other. This fruit was shared. The juice from it is not a stain, just something that fell. We put our hands over our eyes to keep from going blind. We put the china of our limbs into the current, porcelain, smooth, curving. What plates we polished off. The ones you left me with are very pretty. Such golden light the rivers in my country hold. They speak well of you.
What brought you to Portland, Anise?
Originally, it was, I'd been living in Brooklyn, New York, for a year, and was frustrated with not being able to find a new place to live. And so I was like, let me take a break from out here, go hang with my close peeps from college, and perhaps return in a few months. And I came to Portland, and shortly after arriving, me and the gang, we had the opportunity to open up an art gallery. And so I was like, well, let me stick around a little bit longer. And as I say to folks, I feel like the longer one is outside of New York City, the less you want to return to the sacrifices you have to engage in order to live there. And, you know, and I was with like my best friends, and we were making art, and Portland was beautiful, and I just kept staying. So I originally thought I'd be here for, I don't know, a few months, maybe 6 months tops, and stayed here for 6 years, and then moved down to Texas, got married, stopped being married, and found myself needing to heal, and couldn't do it in Austin. And Portland again had so many people that I loved and really felt I needed to be around that. So moved back to Portland so I could start that process. And yeah, so now I've been back in Portland for 5.5 years, I guess. Yeah. An additional 5.5 years. So yeah.
Well, we're very grateful to have you.
I'm grateful to be had by Portland.
So I'd like to explore with you a little bit. As I understand it, you're a member of the Baha'i faith.
Mm-hmm.
And could you tell us a little bit about the role of religion or the relationship of religion to your writing life?
Yeah. So it's, and let me preempt it by, because, you know, this comes into the writing as well, like, I don't know, religion for me over the years, I think that, you know, almost like, I hadn't thought about this before, but, you know, I think that religion is, because I liken faith to being like an ocean, and that for me, at least, that there's an ebb and a flow with regards to like my relationship and my nearness or my distance to whatever larger than me divine source there is. And, you know, that it often feels sometimes as if it's like that, you know, I live here in the city and the ocean is existing 3 hours away, 2 hours away, and it's doing what it does whether or not I am engaging with it. And so there's, I don't know, just kind of like an active relationship that I have and sometimes an inactive relationship, but it is still always like present. And for me, religion is almost kind of like a window through which I'm able to view the ocean. That it frames it. And so, you know, sometimes I'm present in front of that window, and sometimes I'm present in front of a memory of that window, or present in front of an ocean. You know, and so it, with regards to like it, with my writing, I can't, it always feels like something that, regardless of where my relationship to my faith, my relationship to my spirituality is in that ebb and flow, that the tides are continuous. Like I can't remove myself fully from it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that like the way in which that I was raised, which was in this religion, in the Baha'i faith, provided me the navigation of just like how I engage with people in the world around me. That like I don't necessarily know how to not seek making space for all voices. I don't necessarily know how to not seek recognizing my own self-worth and self-power, as well as the nobility in others. And so like all those things also are very, very present in my writing. Regardless of, you know, I don't feel that I write a lot of work that is like specific to being a Baha'i, or even specific to religion, or even specific to God and the spirit. Like, I think God and the spirit definitely pop up by name in many of my poems, but more poems, they do not. Mm-hmm. But there's always an undercurrent, because it's the foundation of just like how I walk through the world, how I commune with nature, how I commune with the universe. And as my writing is simply a reflection of those conversations with myself and the world around me, it's always going to be connected to the spirit. It's always going to be connected to my faith, even when it's not super, super specific.
Let's hear a couple more poems, and then I have a couple more questions to finish up with.
All right. We'll do. Let's see. Don't always get to read from this, so I'll read from this here. This is some stuff from my fourth book, called The Pocket Knife Bible. It's similar to the poem that I shared earlier, Four Stars. It's almost kind of like a longer version of that. It's basically like a book-length poem that is about me being a child in New Orleans. And it extends into some other things. Excuse me. But so I will read one or maybe two parts from it, depending on how long they go. In January, the porch freezes. Me and Shoke use our shoes to skate across the ice before school. On cold mornings, Mom makes oatmeal. On cold, cold mornings, she lays my pants over the heater while I stay under the covers. I can see my breath move out of my mouth. It's like having a superpower. I breathe on the window and turn it a different color. I move my finger across the glass and draw a giraffe. You can only see it when there's something dark on the other side. This is also like a superpower. Me and Mom and Shoke, we plant a tree in front of our house. We have a new brother. His name is Nason. He's like a sailboat, a chubby sailboat. His name means spring rain cloud. Shokafe means blossom. I don't know what Parviz means. He's just Pop. I don't know what Terry means. She's just Mom, or Carolyn, if she's talking to Aunt Diane or Aunt Lynette. I don't like my name. It is only four letters, but still sounds all corners and clumsy in my mouth, like trying to chew the pieces of a plate. And no one ever says it right. It means companion. I wish my name was Mike. It is only four letters and sounds like a knife. In my chest is a pomegranate made out of muscle and a small lion. Parts of my pieces probably don't grow in me, but in the heads of little mice, because when I see them, there is a lightning bridge between us that we walk back and forth between our tiny and invisible skulls. We are so powerful, the owls eat us to fly. We can see in the dark. And I'll read this part from later on in the book, where the boy, me, is traveling through this very strange dream world that where he ends up at some point bumping into his future self, and they go off on some strange adventure. Somewhere between the bodies of the dark house and the gardens, I dreamt a pack of dogs. I followed them. They led me through the woods, and we ended at a campsite that the stars used when on Earth. The tents were still pitched, but all empty, no constellations to be seen, like they had left in a hurry, or like they would be back shortly. The dogs sniffed at the campfire remains. I dreamt I looked at the sky. It looked like a swept floor. I imagined the size of that giant broom, how empty it sounded. In the dream, I sat on a log. In the dream, the dogs began to howl. In the dream, I scratched a stick to the ashes and then joined them in the howling under the sky. How strange that for something to sound empty, it has to make noise inside something else. I felt like we were pouring water down the sink of an abandoned house. A man in a long red cloak walked out of the trees. We stopped howling and watched him. I dreamt he asked to sit with us. Me and the dogs nodded. The man told us he was a writer of operas. He had a practice of writing an opera, then burying it and digging it up a year later. He said he was constantly writing operas and burying them. It seemed like every day a year had passed since one of his operas had been buried, so he was always digging one back up to finish it. He said the time the opera spent away from him, the time they spent in the earth, allowed something to happen. He didn't know if the things that happened were him not remembering the notes or the earth actually changing the music. He said he felt it didn't really matter which one it was. The music was the music. He said he had heard the opera we were pouring out with our bodies. And incidentally, we happened to be in the same place he had buried one last year. He asked if he would help him dig it up. I looked at the dogs. The dogs said nothing. I dreamt I took a shovel from the man's outstretched hand and began lifting the ground with it. I looked over at him. He was singing softly as I shoveled. He sounded like the only canary left in the tunnel, and his cloak was red as the blood of the maple tree. I dreamt I unburied the man's opera, that it looked like a small brass box. I dreamt he opened the box to show me what it looked like. Inside were two brown birds becoming blue. They cleared their throats and started singing. It sounded like walking through a woods and hearing a creek not too far off. I sat in the hole I made, and the man in the red cloak closed his brass box of birds and began filling the hole back up. I dreamt the man said, "You are my opera now." And I said, "Yes." "And you are mine?" And he said, "Yes. When next you unearth me, I will be very different." And I dreamt he covered me with the ground.
Now I have to ask if you did that with your opera that's coming out next spring.
Actually, oddly enough, there is a point in, and I can't remember, it went through many, many drafts, and originally it was supposed to premiere this April. So I've had a lot of space from between it and me, so I can't remember if this is in the final draft or not, but there is a part in there where at some point there is a character in the opera who is writing an opera, and the opera that he is writing is an opera that he's building in the earth, like mm-hmm. The opera is this thing inside of the ground, it's out of this hole that other things start manifesting themselves across the span of the story.
So I wanted to ask you, because I had a conversation by email, and this must have been about 15 years ago, with a poet in another country, and the occasion was that a new national poet laureate here in the U.S. had recently been appointed, and I can't remember now who it was, but the poet that I was corresponding with wanted to know, isn't this very political? I mean, it's a position that's appointed by the president, so it must be political. And my response was, well, it's really kind of not, and this may be a little naive, but because poetry is so kind of removed from public life and from any real kind of political power, that it was sort of hard for me to see the appointment of a poet laureate as being a very political thing. What's your feeling about that? As a laureate yourself, state rather than national, obviously, what do you feel like the relationship of poetry and of art in general to political life is? And how, as laureate, do you feel like you're kind of a pivot point or a nexus for that?
I think it's a mix of stuff. You know, I think that there is, firstly, I do think it's on the shoulders of an individual as an artist what their relationship to their art is and what that responsibility is. But like I do feel that that one's art is inherent that it is a reflection of the world that a person is in at any given time. And so it can't help but have a political bent to it. And when I say that, I don't mean that with regards to like say politics. You know, like I think for me, like the connotation of politics is parties, Republicans, Democrats, the job, the game. And for me, political is that which is life and death, you know, that which is oppression, that which is not oppression, that which is freedom and liberation. And so like, you know, art, I think, has to be reflective of those things. If it's speaking what a person's heart is and speaking to what the hearts of other people are, you know, that on one level, yes, there is, you know, there's a wide range of art and a wide range of poetry, wide range of writing. And all those things come from different places based on like who those artists are and where they come from. So, you know, I think for me as a person of color, as an artist of color, as a Black American, as a Middle Eastern American, like that, similarly to how, you know, when I was speaking about the relationship of my work to religion, regardless of whether or not my work is specifically calling out God, specifically calling out the spirit, it is rooted in that, you know? And so like, as a person of color in America, simply existing is a political act. You know, if the world, if the society that I live in, constantly seeks to marginalize and oppress bodies of color, and by simply existing outside of those boundaries, outside of those boxes, that's a political act. And my work can't help but reflect that life. I think that it's going to always be an element of a political bent, a political edge, so to speak, to work that I'm creating and giving out to people. But I think also definitely, like, particularly right now, you know, that the things that are very heavy on my mind right now is what is the shape of this country that we are in, and the ways in which that it has always been a flawed system, and that we are arriving at a point in the American experiment that is revealing so much more vastly into so many more people, how that experiment is not going in the direction that it set out to. And, you know, those things weigh heavy on my mind, you know? Mm-hmm. The deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor weigh heavy on my mind, just like how the deaths of Alton Sterling still weighs heavy on my mind. Khalif Browder's suicide weighs heavy in my mind every day, you know? And so it's like the world that I live in right now, if my work is a call and response to that which is around me, I can't help but like find work that is speaking to those things. You know, and so it definitely is, it becomes like, I think a little bit, it's a new conversation that I'm having as poet laureate now than say perhaps before, in that like, all right, well, what is my role in this? You know, like, is there an actual like power that I have to my voice and my platform from this position that like these things that I advocate for have a way to reach more people. And also, like, is that appropriate? Is that inappropriate? You know, like, should this position be, like, removed from that? And, you know, and, like, you know, so those are, like, new conversations that I'm having with myself that, like, I didn't have to have before, so to speak. You know, it was like, oh, like, I'm going to write something, and, like, if I want to, like, share it with people, I'm going to share it with people. And, like, if I feel the need to share it with people, I'm going to share it with people. And, you know, I think definitely for me, like, I'm not a person that tends to shy away from my words. There's plenty of ways that I shy away from people. But, you know, long ago when I first started writing poems, the thing that really spoke to me from other poets is, like, these poets are writing things that, like, what if their mom reads this poem? Like, how can they say these things? How can they write them down? And I was like, I want to be like that. I want to be able to, like, take this tool that they've had to be able to say exactly, like, the confusing things that are inside of me, you know? And so, like, regardless of, like, what my position is, you know, like, it's a position that I was assigned. It's a position that I was appointed to. And so I'm going to try to do me the best that I can, regardless of whether or not, like, does this step on toes? Is this not step on toes? Am I allowed to step on toes? Is this conversation irrelevant to me? You know, like, all those things. I'm going to do my best to basically, like, steer my ship in accordance to, like, what my voice wants to do. Yeah, you know, so it definitely is, I think, I don't know, it's weird and it's challenging times, but the times are also, it is imperative for us to, like, seek these challenges head on and have the uncomfortable conversations. And so any ways in which that, like, poems of mine or work of mine that manifest as a result of those conversations, I definitely want to put that forward towards others.
Great. So I have one more question for you, because mm-hmm. I always like to end with a completely random question.
Fantastic.
If you could time travel to one historical event, not to change it, but just to observe it, what would you pick?
I always feel like, I don't know if I would, like, I mean, there's things that I, you know, like, with regards to different artists that I love, I would love to just sort of be able to be like a fly on the wall, you know, to just be able to kind of, like, engage with, like, what does it mean to sort of, like, watch Van Gogh or Basquiat paint, you know? But I think, like, you know, I don't know if I would do something large. Like, I'm very curious as to, like, what my parents were like before being parents, you know? Like, I would love to just, like, go spy upon my parents in the early time of their marriage, of being 22, 25 years old, just to, like, see what that meant, you know? That's what I would want to do. Or to just sort of, like, peek in on me at, like, 8-9 years old, just to kind of, like, get a more solid imagining in my heart of what the boy I was is.
All right, well, thank you so much. My guest this month was Anis Majgani, our new poet laureate, and this has been Wider Window Poetry. As always, thank you for listening.
You are tuned into listener supported Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Hello, and thank you for listening to 90.7 KBOO Portland.